American Prairie is a local nonprofit working to connect and conserve more than 3 million acres of prairie grassland in Montana's northern Great Plains. American Prairie is one of the most ambitious conservation projects in existence today, representing an unprecedented opportunity to preserve temperate grasslands, which are one of the most threatened ecosystems in the world. To learn more about the incredible work American Prairie is doing for birds, habitat, wildlife, and local communities, visit www.americanprairie.org.
This episode of the American Birding Podcast is brought to you by HX Expeditions, offering mindful adventures to curious travelers since 1896. An HX Expedition cruise is the best way to see some of the world's rarest birds, like McKay's bunting. With onboard science centers, ornithologists, photographers, and a range of outdoor activities, an HX Expedition is a birder's paradise. Change the way you see the world. Book now and find out why birders are raving about HX.
Hello, and welcome to the American Birding Podcast from the American Birding Association. I am Birding Magazine editor Ted Floyd, sitting in for our regular podcast host, Nate Swick, who is out this week. Well, I'm guessing that many of you reveled in, or partook in, or otherwise indulged in the Great Eclipse of 2024. It was a total eclipse of the sun back on the afternoon of Monday, April 8th, and it cut across a huge swath of the ABA area. The eclipse per se was not an ornithological phenomenon, I well realize, but it was, I think it is safe to say, a birding adjacent or birding allied phenomenon. Because everybody was out there talking to friends and family, as well as to perfect strangers about the Great Eclipse of 24. And isn't it the same way with birds? Especially at this time of the year, spring migration, we see a great bird, the first osprey of the season, a flock of sandhill cranes migrating over, American white pelicans at a local fishing hole, and everybody is talking about it, just like the eclipse. But here's the thing. Most of us will see only one or two or maybe three total solar eclipses in our lives, but there are incredible birds out there every day, especially at this time of the year. Pretty soon, where I live in Colorado, ridiculously beautiful birds, western tanagers and bullock's orioles and lazuli buntings and black-headed grosbeaks, will be all over the place. And all of us, regardless of what else we believe in, cannot help but smile at the pageantry of spring migration. So get out there and share it with a friend or even a perfect stranger. Shout it from a mountaintop for all the world to hear. Spring migration is upon us. It's as awesome as the eclipse, day after day, bird by bird, delight upon delight. One touch of nature makes the whole world kin, wrote Shakespeare. It was true then, it's as true as ever today. And speaking of the wonders of spring migration, on the show today, we pull from the archives an interview with Dr. Kevin Frazier of the Avian Behavior and Conservation Lab at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg. Kevin is a migration ecologist with a particular interest in neotropical migrants, and he has worked for years with that quintessential early spring migrant, the purple martin. He joined Nate Swick back in 2019 to talk about the uncommon lives of these common and beloved birds. All after this week's Rare Birds.
This Rare Bird Focus is brought to you by the Great Salt Lake Bird Festival, running this May 16th through 19th. Registration is now open. Check aba.org/festivals for more info. Here's your Rare Bird Focus for the first week of April 2024. Strong easterly winds across the North Atlantic have brought a number of European vagrants to Newfoundland on the eastern edge of the ABA area. In the past few days, birders on the island have enjoyed, at the time of this recording, at least 2 whooper swans, 6 barnacle geese, 3 pink-footed geese, 2 greylag geese, 2 common shell ducks, 1 tufted duck, 16 European golden plovers, and perhaps most notably, 1 Eurasian oyster catcher, which was seen walking around in downtown St. John's. Most of the sightings have been on the Avalon Peninsula, but some have been at St. Anthony on the northern tip of the island. This European assemblage has been a mix of regularly occurring vagrants, such as barnacle goose and pink-footed goose, birds that are rare but have been increasing in recent years, like common shell duck and greylag goose, and out-and-out rarities like the oyster catcher. Despite being a common summer resident in Iceland, there are fewer than 10 records of Eurasian oyster catcher in the ABA area. All save a single Alaska record come from Newfoundland. Also of note this week, a stunning male brambling was photographed at a feeder in Taney County, Missouri, representing a first record for that state, and the latest in a spate of records of this nomadic Asian songbird in the ABA area this year, joining birds seen in British Columbia, Colorado, and recently in Utah. Well, that's all we have this week, but for a full list, check out the ABA Rare Bird Alert on Fridays at aba.org/RBA. You can also follow along with this spring's rare bird news in our ABA Rare Bird Alert group on Facebook and on ABA Community.
Spring is finally on its way, and with it, the promise of returning migratory birds to the United States and Canada. Among the first to arrive every year, and among the most beloved among birders and non-birders alike, is North America's largest swallow, the purple martin. They're chatty, they're gregarious, they inspire a ton of people, and one of those people is Dr. Kevin Frazier of the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg. He's a migration ecologist with a particular interest in neotropic migrants, especially purple martins. He's here to talk to me about the uncommon lives of these common birds. Thanks for joining me, Kevin.
Oh, thank you very much. Great to be here.
I always think of purple martins as one of those species that, you know, maybe along with bluebirds and hummingbirds, and that non-birders get super excited about. I know people who are not, by any stretch, birders, but they have a martin house and they take care of it every year. What is it about martins, do you think, that really appeals to people?
I think they offer a chance for a personal connection with a living bird, because you can attract them to artificial housing in your yard. You can watch them come back each spring and use them as sort of a nice sign that spring has arrived or is about to arrive. You can watch the parent birds raise nestlings through the season and see them go, and maybe sometimes see the same ones return again if you're doing banding of birds. So I think they kind of offer a personal window into the lives of birds during the nesting season, which I think is really appealing to a lot of people that put out housing for martins.
Yeah, and they're really easy to take care of, too. I mean, my dad used to have a purple martin house before his yard got too kind of overgrown with trees, and they would come back every year, the same martins. I imagine that makes studying them a lot easier.
It does, yeah. There are so many sort of black boxes of migration and all sorts of research questions that we couldn't really get at with other kinds of migratory birds, because they're more spread out in the landscape, their nests are harder to find. But having sort of accessible long-distance migrants that take readily to housing and that we can watch and collect other data is really valuable to our research. And we hope we can use that to learn things about migratory birds in general through our work with martins.
So what does a purple martin's year typically look like?
Well, because they have such a broad range in terms of where they breed all the way from Florida to central Alberta, it can differ a little bit across latitude. But for the most part, they're breeding in North America across that range. And then they're spending a decent part of the year on spring and fall migration. And they're spending most of their year, whether you're a Florida martin or an Alberta martin, actually in the tropics and mostly in the Amazon basin that we found. Spring migration tends to be a lot faster than fall migration. So some purple martins are getting all the way back to their breeding sites in just over 2 weeks.
Wow.
And for some birds, that can be, you know, over 10,000 kilometers. So it's quite a journey in a very short time in spring. In fall, some populations and some individuals tend to be a little more leisurely on fall migration. They might spend up to a month at some stopovers. So that fall migration journey takes a little longer.
Mm-hmm. I know that in fall migration, one of the places where I live in North Carolina, out on the coast, there's an old bridge that seems to attract hundreds of thousands of purple martins every year in the fall for like a 2 week period. And people go out underneath the bridge, and you can like sit underneath this like mass of purple martins. It's one of the really cool things about them that they migrate in these surprisingly large groups. They're traveling together a lot.
Yeah, that's another thing that really attracts people to martins as well, is this big sort of natural spectacle, these large post-breeding roosts that they make. And you can see those all the way from the northern end of the range and in southern Canada all the way to all the way through the southern U.S. But those roosts are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, we think, as the birds are moving further south, because they can draw in more migrants from further north, and they all seem to mix at those sites. And there are a few things about those roofs. One thing is that they're in sort of huge numbers, so the greater safety from predators. There are a lot of aerial predators that might want to eat a marten on their own migrations. And while the martens are migrating mostly, we think, individually or in small groups, they do seem to aggregate in large numbers at their stopovers, like the one you're describing.
Swallows in general are mostly diurnal migrants. Is that correct? I imagine martens are the same for the most part.
Yeah, there's sort of a general pattern that we think most swallows use, which is to have a fly and forage strategy on migration. So that means flying and hawking and feeding on insects while they're migrating. Because unlike a lot of other songbirds, they're doing both their migration and we think they're refueling during the day. So there's sort of that bottleneck there in time, whereas other songbirds are, you know, migrating through the night and then foraging during the day. So they spread that out a bit. But we think martens are probably doing, and like other swallows are probably doing that together. We're getting a few new insights onto how much they may use some night travel through our tracking research. But mostly they're using daytime flights.
So how are you tracking these birds?
Well, we're using a variety of techniques. We started with light level geolocators and are still using those. So little tracking devices that record day length and time. And from that, we can get latitude long positions of where the birds are. So these are little, you know, 1 gram devices that the bird carries with them, like a little backpack, to record where they are. More recently, we're using different generations of GPS tracking tags. They give us positions that are a little bit more precise, and we can kind of program when they will connect with satellites and take a point. And those are precise down to about 10 meters. So those data are really exciting to get back when you can, you know, sit in the lab and zoom in on the clump of trees where a marten may have roosted on its migration or somewhere in the Amazon.
So these martens are traveling in these big flocks. Do you like to spread these kind of backpacks out? Have you ever had, you know, more than one tracked bird in one flock that's moving around?
We've never been able to identify birds that are traveling together. We do definitely spread them out. Through the years, we've developed strong ties with all sorts of individual citizen scientists, NGOs, including the Purple Marten Conservation Association, so that we can track birds from places from across the breeding range. And now we've expanded that work more recently into work at the overwintering site. So we have a couple of partners in South America as well that we're now working with for tracking and citizen science data as well. So we're really aiming for a range-wide approach.
Oh, neat. What have you found, just kind of generally speaking, that you may not have known about how purple martens migrate, how they're moving across the landscape?
Oh, good question. I think we were surprised every new season of research because there's been such a black box in terms of their movements and migration. One of the first things that really surprised us was how much within winter movement they're doing. So this is movement that they would do after they get to their overwintering sites, which we found are mostly in the Amazon basin. So after traveling, you know, 5,000 to 10,000 kilometers on fall migration, depending where their breeding site was, they might travel an additional 1,000, 1,500 kilometers around the Amazon afterwards. So, whereas we think a lot of songbirds are sort of a little more sedentary and usually territorial at their overwintering sites. But martens are aerial throughout the whole overwintering season. And it's not like they're moving through the winter and getting closer and closer to their breeding sites to get a jump on spring migration. Often it's in the opposite direction. So their spring migration ends being even longer than their fall migration.
Wow. How many kilometers or miles do you think that an individual purple martin might be moving in a year?
Well, the max that we've tracked so far is about 22,500 kilometers for one individual bird. So it's quite amazing.
10,000, 12,000 miles. Yeah, that's crazy.
So, you know, 45 gram bird that can fit in the palm of your hand is just, yeah, traveling those massive distances and sometimes quite quickly as well. So we have some migration rates for them too.
Yeah, I've heard stories from people who have birded the Amazon or been on like a boat ride on the Amazon River or the Orinoco or something, and there's these, and you're kind of motoring along, and there are these sandbars in the middle, and there's like purple martens there in the winter. They're just like hanging out, like they're tropical birds. It's so strange to me.
Yeah, absolutely, and really, when you look at their calendar, we think of them as our breeding birds, and they are. They're doing something really important in North America, but most of their year, for most populations, they're spending time there. So It's really important to know what's going on at that end of their migration as well. And yeah, we've tracked them to sort of a lot of little islands actually and peninsulas. They tend to roost in the Amazon on the kinds of places that you just described. So sort of areas that are flooded and small islands within the Amazon Basin, Rio Negro.
Do they hang out with other marten species? I know there's quite a few tropical martens. They're a little bit different, like the white-bellied kind. Do they tend to hang out with those birds when they're there in the winter?
Yeah, sometimes there's overlap in roost use and they're flocking together. So brown-chested martens and some other progeny species are there at the same time and overlap a little bit.
I love these bird tracking studies. I mean, I generally can't get enough of them. Like you're suddenly aware of all these movements that you wouldn't see if you're not sort of watching these individual birds. Has there been anything that, besides the fact that these birds are moving, you know, tens of thousands of kilometers over the course of a year, have you noticed anything about their behavior that has like really, really surprised you?
Yeah, there have been a few things over time that have really stood out. One important thing about these tracking studies is that you can connect populations across vast distances. So if you have, you know, a given breeding population and you see it's declining, it's important to know, well, where is it spending time the rest of the year and what's happening there? So if you have a population that's strongly connected between breeding and wintering, then you can sort of manage those populations together and you can expect effects to kind of be connected. But then the other pattern is where you have more weak connectivity. So you have birds that are all mixing together from different populations. Mm-hmm. So when we first started working with tracking with geolocators, we were trying to see if any given breeding population is sort of staking out its own separate wintering range or if they're all mixing when they get to South America. And we found at the scale of the geolocators, we found lots of mixing in the Amazon Basin, thinking that they're kind of in the same general region. So a bird that breeds in Florida or a bird that breeds in Manitoba, where I am, might end up kind of in the same general region in the winter. But then when we switched to using GPS tracking tags as well, and we programmed them to tell us where birds were roosting at night, so we expect them to be roosting in flocks like they do in other places, we found that connectivity is the same and that mixing is the same down to sort of that 10-meter scale. So We had this huge surprise where we found that a bird that had bred in Florida, one in Ontario, one in Pennsylvania, one in Alberta, had all been possibly, you know, roosting almost shoulder to shoulder on the same tiny little island, Amazon River. So we had to really look at things carefully. We first wondered if we'd reloaded the same data twice or made some error, but no, there's that kind of mixing of populations that, you know, birds that might be breeding 2,000 kilometers apart are sharing that same little clump of habitat. So how important are those habitats then
right.
to birds from across the range? And it wasn't, that sort of started to appear again and again. It wasn't just at that one location, that one time. We found similar mixing kind of across migration too. We found a whole bunch of birds using the same tiny little delta island off the coast of Nicaragua, like during migration itself as well. So there might be a lot of sort of shared habitats and mixing across the whole range of martens and around the calendar.
So these family groups that come together during the breeding season that use these marten houses, they're not necessarily staying together when they leave, when they overwinter, or are they? And they're just part of these larger groups.
I think that they might by accident end up the same roost, just because we think that some of these roosts might harbor, you know, 100,000 birds or more. Mm-hmm. And because they're in the same region, you might end up with family birds that are together. But in terms of actually traveling together or spending time together after the nesting season, we think that they don't really maybe do that at all. We were able to look at that by tracking mated pairs with geolocators.
So
a group of birds that we tracked from the breeding season, and we found that very quickly after the breeding season ended, the pair parted ways and weren't stopping in the same places at the same time. And they came back in the following year to the same site and didn't necessarily breed together again either. So it's sort of it seems that the way that they pair might be more related to sort of time of arrival and timing at the site more than anything else.
That's really interesting.
And we don't think that the young are staying with their parents much beyond the post-breeding period.
First year, yeah.
Yeah. Huh.
You've also expanded your work to Eastern whippoorwills, which is another sort of iconic insect-eating bird, but one that's definitely more mysterious. What have you discovered with them?
Well, that work has just begun. Mm-hmm. Part of the interest in working with another aerial insectivore is that one thing they share as a group is that we're seeing really steep population declines across North America in all of those birds that are feeding aerially, so purple martins and whippoorwills. And the whippoorwill is sort of similar to the martin in that they're mostly nocturnal and foraging and migrating at night, whereas with martins doing the opposite during the day. So there's some interest there too in what their behaviors might be like. We've started tracking whippoorwills with GPS tags and also with MODIS radio tags, which I can tell you too. And with the GPS tags, we're finding that a lot of synchrony so far in the timing of the migration of the whippoorwills we tracked. These ones were from Ontario. And we're finding that they tend to have all their migratory movements during dark hours, as you might expect for a nocturnal bird. And one thing we're investigating is whether that might limit where they travel and what they're able to do in terms of barrier crossing.
Right. So, and where would they eat too? Because they forage at night as well.
Right.
So they're doing the same thing that the martins are doing, just the opposite. They're feeding and migrating at the same time.
Right. And that might be a different sort of need to look at that in the nocturnal situation. And then with whippoorwills too, we're also interested in looking at their tracking and their migration routes because of all of the anthropogenic light that they have to sort of pass on their way from northern breeding sites to Central America. And if you look at that in sort of a light pollution map, you can see there are very few dark areas between the brightly lit areas that they would have to move through if they were going to avoid that light. So we have, we're going to build some sort of theoretical best routes to show where they should go if they're going to try to avoid light pollution on the way down. And then we're overlaying our actual migration tracks on that to see if they are kind of deviating in time and space in relation to where they're encountering light.
Yeah, that's got to be fascinating because, you know, purple martins you see all the time in spring and fall migration. But whippoorwill, man, that is a bird that, I mean, they could be declining. They are declining. And you wouldn't even know it just by virtue of like you don't encounter them nearly as often.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we found we were starting at with an even bigger black box with whippoorwill. And the martins, you know, are much loved as you described in the intro and often seen, and those roosts are such big natural spectacles, whereas we have sort of cryptic nocturnal migrant that we don't know anything about. So I think that we're set to find out a lot more about their migration right from the beginning through the tracking.
Yeah, that's really cool. You've been doing a lot of writing about how climate change is affecting martins and whips for that matter too. I guess the worry is that you know, spring is breaking out earlier, so the insects that they rely on are sort of appearing potentially before these insect eating birds arrive, certainly in Canada, where sort of hitting that sweet spot is more important than it might be further south where there's, you know, kind of year-round activity. Is that what you're seeing? Are martins able to sort of adjust their own schedule to account for these things to some extent?
Yeah, I think considering that aerial insectivores are showing declines across species that have very different behaviors and time in very different places, we'd have to sort of lean towards something tied to their food. And then we're thinking about how does that food change with climate and its availability. So a lot of our work is trying to look at how flexible martins and now whippoorwills are in relation to those sorts of changes. Because as you described, they might really sort of miss the boat on peak if they're not well-timed. So the way we've looked at it so far in martins is to see if in really early springs and when we have advanced springs in North America, if they're changing their timing to meet that. So are they sort of flexible along the way? Can they speed up and stop over less? And ramp up the timing of their migration to sort of meet those new conditions. And what we found so far is that they aren't really. They seem consistent in their timing from year to year, and they might not actually be arriving earlier at their breeding sites when spring is much advanced. So that's what we've found with them so far. We're also wondering how much light may play into that as well. So if young birds are, if their timing is entrained by the photo period that they experience in the nest, as we think they are, then if birds are breeding earlier and earlier, then we should end up with earlier and earlier birds, which is great and would be great for them to meet conditions with climate change. But we don't know if that actually happens very well in the wild. So one thing now is extending day length in the nest boxes of some of the martins that we study to see if that impacts their timing and if we end up with earlier birds when we have a light signal that's earlier.
There have been a lot of reports recently about the sort of declining numbers of insects in North America and in Europe as well. You suggested that a lot of these insect-eating birds, cause of their decline, may have something to do with food rather than climate change. Do you think that those are connected?
It could be sort of a two-part problem. And one is that we have these overall declines of insect numbers, partially due to intensive agriculture. But then we also have big changes in their availability. So insects can be much more flexible in their timing to local conditions, and therefore you have an early spring, late spring, the insects are maybe more matched than the birds would be. And then we have these birds that have to sort of arrive on time from 10,000 kilometers away to kind of match their timing with whatever that peak food happens to be. And as that becomes more variable, then I think the birds end up having a greater difficulty in matching what they need with peak food. And part of it is how flexible are they in the timing of the migration? And then part of it is once they're on site, how flexible are they in the timing of their nesting itself? So they could potentially change when they lay their eggs to match whatever the timing of peak food is that year. But that's sort of the area that we're investigating to see just how flexible they are. And if they even have enough time to be flexible like that after they arrive at the more northern latitudes that martins breed, timing is really short and there might not really be much time after they arrive to be flexible as to when they start breeding. Whereas at the very opposite end in Florida, birds might arrive 1 or 2 months before they actually start breeding. So there may be more flexibility there and or at least the opportunity for flexibility in birds breeding at more southern latitudes.
Does the type of insects that are impacted by some of these agricultural concerns, does that affect purple martins and to a lesser extent or equal extent as whippoorwills as well? I know whippoorwills like those big silk moths, and there's certainly fewer of those around.
Yeah, I think probably because those effects are sort of affecting the whole sort of insect community and food chain, it would have to have sort of an impact across species. We've done a little bit of research on what martins are eating when they're here in Manitoba, and mostly what they're focused on at the end of nesting for their larger nestlings are big darner dragonflies. That's most of they're getting at the end. Yeah, they start off with smaller prey, and at the end, that's almost exclusively dragonflies. And some of those are also migratory and might use to martins. But since those are predatory insects, they would be reliant upon smaller insects for food. Right. So they have sort of an overall reduction in insect abundance that would probably affect everybody.
Dr. Kevin Fraser is the director of the Avian Behavior and Conservation Lab at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg. He writes often about his work with purple martins. You can find links to his stuff at abclab.ca. Thanks again, Kevin. Fascinating.
Oh, thank you very much.
The American Birding Podcast is brought to you by the American Birding Association. Don't forget to join the ABA if you enjoy this podcast. You'll be eligible for a lot of great benefits, including our magazines, all our online stuff like the magazine archive and the new identification portal, and, of course, discount to partners like OM System, Budio Books, Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and more. Special shout out to Ryan Borman of DePere, Wisconsin, Benjamin Dillard and family of Clinton, Mississippi, Ryan Gannon of Lakewood, Colorado, Robert Gerhardt from Cedar Park, Texas, and Kate Jackman from Ypsilanti, Michigan, all of whom recently joined the ABA and noted this podcast as a reason for doing so. Thanks so much and welcome to the ABA. Executive Director of the ABA and Executive Producer of this podcast is Wayne Klockner. Technical production is by John Lowry. Additional help comes from Maggie Fitzgibbon and Greg Neese. You can find us online at aba.org and on social media almost everywhere as American Birding Association. But on Blue Sky, we are ABA Bird. Questions and comments can come to podcast@aba.org. Thanks for listening. Bird like Tom, and we'll see you next week.